Welcome to the 2022 Volume 4, Issue 1, Summer Podcast Edition, Part 1, of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion, published May 25, 2025. All contents are protected under the Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives, 4.0 International Deed. For figures, citations, notes, and references, please refer to the printed articles at www.jpeonline.org. Part 1. Table of Contents. Call by Michael. 2022. Precy. Grief. A Philosophical Guide. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 4 Number 1. 1-5. https://doi.org/10.33497/2022summer.1. Garland C. 2022. Vicarious Grief, Mental Health, and the Duty to Grieve. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 4 Number 1. 6-12. https://doi.org/10.33497/2022summer.2. Benzaev Aaron. 2022. Grief and the Emotion. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 4 Number 1. 13-17. https://doi.org/10.33497/2022summer.3. Timmerman, Travis. 2022. Grief's Badness and the Paradox of Grief. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 4 Number 1. 18-26. https://doi.org/10.33497/2022summer.4.
Article 1. Grief. A Philosophical Guide. By Michael Kalbai. Philosophy has a long history of investigating the significance of our mortality. Whether, for example, death is a harm to us, whether it merits fear, etc. But these investigations have focused almost exclusively on the significance our own deaths have for us, instead of on the significance that others' deaths have for us. Most notably, grief, the paradigmatic human response to the deaths of others, receives only very sporadic attention from philosophers. And when philosophers have investigated grief, their attitude toward it has often been negative, even hostile. The prevailing attitude toward grief in the ancient Mediterranean philosophical tradition, for example, was a grudging acceptance that we humans grieve, juxtaposed with a dismissal of grief as a grandiose or womanly emotion that betrays an unhealthy dependence on others rather than the self-sufficiency that characterizes the virtuous person. LaBarge, 2012. Grief, a Philosophical Guide, aims to remedy both this philosophical inattention to grief and the antagonism that grief has often elicited among philosophers. Not only is grief a worthy subject for philosophers, it represents a defining human experience. The book argues that though grief is not always a desirable or rational response to others' death, it often is, and it in fact manifests some of the most admirable human qualities, including the sophistication of our emotional palate, our capacity for adaptation, and our ability to interweave past, present, and future. At the very least, we ought to feel grateful rather than ashamed at the fact that we grieve others' deaths. Grief, a Philosophical Guide, develops the rudiments of a philosophical theory of grief across 7 chapters. Grief is not our response to the fact of mortality as such. Only some of our responses to others' deaths are grief responses. Rather, we undergo grief in response to the deaths of specific, identifiable individuals. This raises the question of what facts must hold true in order for us to grieve the deaths of others. Chapter 1 argues that grief does not require that we be intimate with the deceased, that we love them, that we are attached to them, or that they contributed positively to our well-being. While one or more of these features will usually be present in the relationships we have with those we grieve, they are not essential to grief. I propose instead that we grieve for those in whom we have invested our practical identities, i.e., those whose existence is assumed in our understandings of what we care about and in our goals or hopes for the future. This account explains how grief is not limited to loved ones, but can extend to role models, political leaders, revered cultural figures, etc. Furthermore, That we grieve those in whom our practical identities are invested helps explain the egocentric character of grief. How it is that grief registers a loss both to the self and a partial loss of the self. Chapter 2 takes up the nature of grief as an emotional condition. Grief proves difficult to describe and taxonomize in the terms familiar in the philosophical literature on the emotions. Despite having an extended duration and coloring other emotional responses, grief is not a mood. But nor is grief a single emotional state. For while few grief episodes conform to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross canonical five-stage model of denial slash anger slash bargaining slash depression slash acceptance, grief nevertheless involves several different emotions experienced at different moments. Sorrow or sadness is the most prominent among these, but grief can also involve anxiety, guilt, resentment, confusion, emotional numbness, etc. Grief is thus a multi-state emotional process. Grief also differs from more standard emotions in two other ways. First, grief is a kind of emotionally driven attention. As we grieve, we are paying attention to a salient fact, namely, the fact of the death of someone in whom we have invested our practical identities. The different emotions we undergo in grief are different species of attention directed at different dimensions of our relationship with the deceased. Second, grief is not a process we can dictate, but it is nevertheless an activity. We do not confront grief in a wholly passive way. Rather, in grieving, we respond to our emotions deliberately, choosing and acting in ways that can facilitate transitions within a grief episode, as when, for example, a grieving spouse finally decides to remove the deceased spouse's clothing from shared closet. Grief is thus a more intricate emotional condition than the emotions that philosophers tend to analyze, such as fear. However, that grief is an active process of emotional attention generates questions about its nature that do not arise for seemingly more simple emotions. For instance, how are the various emotional states in a grief episode interrelated such that we ought to view these as components of a single, coherent experience? Moreover, what explains the variations both in how different individuals grieve in response to the same death? That two siblings might grieve their parents' death differently, e.g., and in how one and the same individual grieves differently in response to different deaths, that a person will grieve a coworker's death differently from the death of their child, e.g. These facts are best explained by positing that the object of grief, the fact that renders our grief reactions intelligible responses to their causes, is the loss of the bereaved's relationship with the deceased as it was. Grief, in other words, is an emotional reaction that tracks the identity crisis that occurs when another person, a person around which our concerns and goals are to some degree oriented, can no longer play the roles they previously played in our relationship with them and in our lives as a whole. The variety of emotional states we find in grief episodes thus reflects the wide variety of different relationships we bear to one another and the numerous ways in which our interpersonal relationships contribute to our practical identities. Chapters 3 and 4 together address what I call the paradox of grief. On the one hand, grief is an effectively taxing, even arduous, condition involving several emotions that we ordinarily have reason to avoid. At the same time, though, grief does not seem to be a condition we should want to avoid altogether. Rather, grief is a fundamentally human experience that can contribute to how happy or meaningful one's life is. How? In other words, can a condition that usually feels very bad be good for us all the same? The third chapter proposes that grief represents a distinctive opportunity for the good of self-knowledge. The deaths of others in whom our practical identities are invested highlights that our practical identities and the values, goals, etc., incorporated therein are not simply givens that can be taken for granted, but hinge on the existence of our relationships with others. When they die, then, our relationships with them can no longer proceed under the existing terms and must change. Hence, by compelling us to reconsider and reconfigure our practical identities, the deaths of those in whom our identities are invested discloses a large amount of information about our own goals, values, commitments, and so on, as well as motivating us to consider how those deaths should alter these. Grief thus represents a robust opportunity for us to renew our practical identities through an exercise of active agency that culminates in self-knowledge. The claim that grief affords us valuable self-knowledge does not fully resolve the paradox of grief. However, for many individuals seem drawn to the more painful aspects of the grief experience, as if these aspects were themselves good or desirable. Chapter 4 answers this worry by showing how the psychological pains associated with grief can contribute to its value and indeed are indispensable to it. In the absence of such pains, grief would not be able to play the special role it plays in fostering self-knowledge. Bereaved individuals may therefore be unwittingly pursuing self-knowledge by pursuing painful grief experiences as if those experiences were good per se. The pains we undergo in grief are therefore neither instances of masochism nor mere cost to be borne in exchange for the goods of grief. They are instead genuine pains that, within the distinctive context of grief episodes, are good pains. Chapter 5 of Grief, a philosophical guide, addresses the conditions under which our grief responses are rational. I reject both the view that grief is irrational, not subject to rational appraisal at all, and the view that grief is necessarily irrational, involving an inherently contradictory combination of attitudes. I propose instead that grief is contingently rational, where the primary measure of its rationality is retrospective. That is, it is rational when the emotions we feel are appropriate, both qualitatively and quantitatively, to the loss of the relationship we suffer because of the other's death. Still, even though grief is often rational in these respects, it can undermine the rationality we are expected to demonstrate when making decisions either for our dying loved ones or for the dead. In fact, the emotional attachment we often have toward those individuals can complicate our efforts to make choices in accordance with their values or beliefs. As the example of Massault and Camus' The Stranger illustrates, the lack of, or complete absence of, grief can be subject to moral criticism. But in what sense can grief be morally owed to someone? Distinguishing between the personal psychological process of grief and the behavioral manifestations of grief that we observe in mourning, I argue in Chapter 6 that not grieving or grieving inadequately are not moral wrongs to the dead or to other bereaved individuals, though we can wrong both such parties with respect to mourning. The duty to grieve, I suggest, is intimately tied to the good of grief that I identified in Chapter 3, namely, grief's distinctive capacity to enable substantial self-knowledge of our identities, values, and goals. The duty to grieve is in fact an imperfect self-regarding duty whose fulfillment constitutes an enhancement or perfection of our rational agency. When grief results in substantial self-knowledge, we stand in a more rational relationship to our conceptions of the good and can live more authentically. By fostering self-knowledge, grief puts us in a better position to know what we are doing with our lives. Controversies have arisen over the past decade concerning whether psychiatry and the mental health professions should recognize a grief-specific mental disorder. As many have observed, grief often has symptoms similar to recognized mental disorders, such as depression. Shall we conclude, then, that a person can be sick with grief? Chapter 7 provides reasons to resist this conclusion. Admittedly, grief often seems to lessen our sense of well-being and our ability to function in our normal social environments. But in most cases, these are short-lived phases that seem to reflect nothing dysfunctional or pathological about the bereaved person. Indeed, inasmuch as they represent intelligible responses to the upsetting events that prompt them, they're equally likely to be signs of good underlying mental health as they are signs of mental illness. In addition, we should be wary of introducing a grief-specific mental disorder because its introduction will likely result in widespread self-diagnosis and influence how bereaved individuals experience grief. In a way similar to how classifying alcoholism as a disease rather than as a moral failing has altered how alcoholics understand their condition. Medicalizing grief may well impede rather than catalyze the self-knowledge that makes grief good for us. This conclusion is nevertheless compatible with individuals seeking medical treatment for particularly difficult grief episodes, insofar as they exhibit the symptoms, sadness, anxiety, etc., characteristic of some other mental disorder. Grief, a philosophical guide, does not address every philosophically substantial question grief raises. In this respect, it should not be treated as the last word on the philosophy of grief. Nonetheless, it aims to bring systematic theoretical order to the piecemeal observations about grief that philosophers have tended to offer. In so doing, it illustrates that grief merits greater philosophical attention. And though the book's aims are not directly therapeutic, it may allay the fear we feel in anticipating grief and provide valuable perspective on grief episodes we have already encountered. If its conclusions are correct, guarded optimism about grief is in order. Grief is admittedly emotionally vexatious, but it also represents an opportunity to restore hope and a sense of meaningful agency when human mortality unavoidably intervenes.
Article 2. Vicarious Grief, Mental Health, and the Duty to Grieve, by C. Garland. Michael Kalbai's 2021 book, Grief, A Philosophical Guide, was a pleasure to read. Grief is a topic that Kalbai rightly notes is of great philosophical interest, though one would not guess by the amount of philosophy that has been written on it. Kalbai also correctly, though perhaps too modestly, notes that his book just scratches the surface of what work could be done on the philosophy of grief. As much as this is true, I take each set of comments that follow to further illustrate a number of interesting philosophical questions that grief, and perhaps Kalbai's account of it, raises. The first set of comments regards the extent to which Kalbai's account of grief, quasi-grief in particular, provides an understanding of vicarious grief. The second set of comments concerns the paradox of grief and the good of grief, and suggests one reason we may recommend grief is that grieving is healthy. The final set of comments pertains to the duty to grieve, and whether this duty may extend to other emotionally rich activities, such as falling in love. Quasi-grief and vicarious grief. One question Kalbai seeks to answer is for whom it is that we grieve. While we may mourn a great number of people, according to Kalbai, we grieve for those in whom we have invested our practical identities, page 31. The object of grief is the pre-mortem, identity-invested relationship the survivor had with the deceased, pages 56 to 7. The grief that results from the loss of that relationship I will call personal grief. Vicarious grief stands in contrast to personal grief. It seems that we can grieve for what another has lost, even if we did not experience that loss ourselves. When not close to the deceased, you sometimes experience grief-like responses, distress, anxiety, and the like if you are close to someone who was close to the deceased. I will focus for now on cases of vicarious grief in which we have invested our practical identities in the bereaved, who in turn had invested her practical identity in the deceased. For instance, when your best friend's parent passes away. Here I would like to explore the extent to which Kalbai's account of grief can be extended to such cases of vicarious grief. Is vicarious grief grief proper, of the same kind as personal grief? Or is it something different? If it isn't grief proper, then perhaps to capture vicarious grief's grief-like nature, we could appeal to Kalbai's notion of quasi-grief. However, as I will explain below, that is inconsistent with what Kalbai identifies as the material cause of grief. On the other hand, if it is grief proper, then vicarious grief like personal grief is egocentric. But that does not seem correct, for in vicarious grief we are concerned primarily for our friends rather than ourselves. It seems vicarious grief could not be grief proper, though I will revisit this shortly. For the object of grief, the identity-invested relationship with the deceased, is often absent. In many cases of vicarious grief, we have no relationship with the deceased, but instead with someone who did. This does not strike me as wrong. There certainly seems to be a difference between personal grief and vicarious grief. Yet, given the grief-like emotional responses we experience when we grieve vicariously, it would be natural to expect vicarious grief to also be grief-like, if not grief proper. This is where Kalbai's notion of quasi-grief may be useful. We quasi-grieve when we respond to the death of another with one or more of the phenomenological features of grief, distress and the like, but fail to direct attention at what I have argued is grief's object, the relationship transformed by the death of the deceased. Quasi-grief can arise when grief attends to some other object or when grief fails to attend to any object at all. Page 117. This description of quasi-grief looks as though it can be applied to cases of vicarious grief. In vicarious grief, I respond to the death of my friend's parent with some of the phenomenological features of grief. However, my attention is not directed at grief's object, my non-existent relationship with the deceased. It is instead directed at my friend and their loss. When I turn my attention to grief's object, some of the phenomenological features subside. Why? Because once I do, I realize that I have nothing to grieve over, having had no significant relationship with the deceased. If we understand vicarious grief as an instance of quasi-grief, we can both capture the idea that there is something genuinely grief-like in vicarious grief and its phenomenology, and explain why vicarious grief is not grief proper. However, other features of Kalbei's account of grief prevent vicarious grief from counting as either grief proper or vicarious grief. For the cause of both grief and quasi-grief is the loss of the relationship with the deceased, pages 56, 117. But that cannot be the cause of my vicarious grief, for I had no relationship with my friend's parent. If grief must be caused by grief's object, then vicarious grief is neither grief proper nor quasi-grief. But if that is so, why is vicarious grief so grief-like? I began with the claim that vicarious grief could not be grief proper, because in vicarious grief the object of grief, the identity-invested relationship with the deceased, is often absent. Let's return to that latter assumption. Perhaps there is a sense in which I was invested in my friend's parent, though indirectly. For my concern for her is concern for who she is, including the foundation of what she values in and about herself. So, my concern for my friend is entangled with concern for her practical identity. Her practical identity depends, in some sense, on her parent. And my practical identity depends on her and her practical identity. My practical identity was thus invested in her parent to the extent that I was invested in her and her practical identity, and she was invested in her parents. So, when her parent dies, she is shaken, but I am shaken too. Vicarious grief, however, seems to lack what Kalbei calls the egocentric aspect of personal grief. Personal grief is egocentric in that we grieve when and because the death of another person is particularly or acutely significant for us, page 23. But we grieve vicariously, it seems, when and because we recognize that the death of another person is particularly or acutely significant to someone we care about, not ourselves. So, one may object that we cannot appeal to the entanglement of practical identities to account for vicarious grief. For, if my practical identity is indeed invested in the practical identity of my friend's parent, then my vicarious grief is egocentric. Though mitigated through my concern for my friend, it is still a matter of my practical identity. The paradox of grief and the good of grief. My next few comments concern the paradox of grief and the good of grief. The paradox of grief stems from two apparently inconsistent observations. First, because grief feels bad, it should be lamented or avoided. Second, something about grief is valuable, and so we ought not avoid it altogether, page 69. In fact, despite grief's pains, in many cases we would recommend grief. Kalbei's solution comes in two parts. First, the identification of what makes grief valuable. Grief is valuable because it provides a remarkable opportunity for self-knowledge, or, perhaps more accurately, self-understanding. However, given the first half of the paradox that grief is painful, this does not explain why we recommend that others grieve and want to grieve ourselves. After all, the pains could outweigh any good. In the second part of his solution to the paradox of grief, Kalbei explains that we inchoately view the pains of grief as an investment in self-knowledge, and thus find the pains of grief desirable. Pages 116-7, 119-20. Beyond resolving the paradox of grief, the identification of grief's good with the opportunity for self-knowledge has another thing to recommend it. It is an insight that non-philosophers recognize. In the latter half of 2020, my father passed away unexpectedly. Some weeks later, I was having a conversation with a close friend who had recently had a miscarriage. You and I seem to be built in a way that we are constantly soul-searching and learning, and I think that's why we overcome so much, she remarked. She recognized that grief provides an opportunity for the kinds of things that we would expect to lead to self-understanding. Just a few days later, The New York Times ran a piece in which wellness and lifestyle coaches explained that an openness to learning and understanding is a key factor in resilience. If grief's end is self-knowledge, which requires an openness to reflection on oneself, we should then also expect that individuals open to such learning and understanding would find that their grief resolves more easily than others. Yet, there is one straightforward response to the paradox of grief that Kalbei does not touch on in his book. That is that we recommend grief and find it desirable because grief is healthy. I want myself and my loved ones to grieve when appropriate, because I am concerned that a failure to do so either reflects a current mental disturbance or will result in mental health problems in the future. This may sound closest to the model of grief's pains as a cost we must bear in order to achieve the good of grief, in this case, improved mental health. We must deal with the pain of grief to ensure that we will be better off in the future than we otherwise would have been. A problem Kalbei identifies with the pains as a necessary cost explanation of the paradox of grief is that the bereaved often finds the pains of grief desirable in their own right. Pages 111-2. We wouldn't minimize the cost in exchange for the good. Pages 108-9. And we are drawn to the pains of grief. Page 110. Kalbei argues that the bereaved find the pains of grief desirable because they grasp, however inchoately, that these pains are an investment in the good of grief. Pages 113-4. Recognizing the pains as an investment in the good goes beyond considering them a cost. We think they are valuable because of the integral causal relationship they stand to the good we seek. Page 114. For Kalbei, the good of grief is self-knowledge. But perhaps the same could be said for our mental health. We are, however inchoately, also invested in our mental health, and also have some inchoate understanding that the pains of grief are causally integral to improving or preserving our mental health. And so, we find the pains of grief desirable. I find the omission of this response surprising, as it seems to me one of the answers that anyone might give to the question of why should we grieve, alongside other responses such as, to honor the dead, etc. Some of Kalbei's remarks in the text suggest a close connection between self-knowledge and our well-being. For instance, he writes, "Grief that culminates in self-knowledge thus enables us to avoid alienation or fragmentation of our sense of self," page 100, that the knowledge achieved through grief is primarily knowledge of our own good, of the ends that serve as elements of our evolving practical identity, page 158, and it clarifies what matters to us and this renders our ends, and our lives as a whole, more rationally transparent to us. Page 159, emphasis added. As our well-being seems closely connected to our mental health, here I would like to invite Kalbei to expand on these remarks. What is the connection, if any, between the self-knowledge grief provides us, our mental health, and our well-being more broadly? The duty to grieve. What I was perhaps most unsure of was the duty to grieve. I don't disagree with Kalbei's suggestion that we have an imperfect duty to acquire self-knowledge, pages 155-6. Nor do I disagree with Kalbei's claim that grief provides a distinctive opportunity for self-knowledge. However, I don't quite understand how that generates a duty for us to grieve in particular. Kalbei writes that because grief is a rich opportunity for such self-knowledge, and we have a duty to pursue such self-knowledge, there is therefore a duty to grieve, page 155. Yet in life we find many opportunities for self-knowledge, and I would like to know more about what it is about grief, in particular that generates this duty. For, as I explain below, there are surprising but notable similarities between grieving and falling in love. And while I am sympathetic to the idea that we have a duty to grieve, I do not think we have a duty to fall in love. Before I continue, let me note a few assumptions. First, when I refer to falling in love, I mean love in the romantic sense. Second, falling in love with someone is not the same as loving them. Falling in love seems to run its course in two ways. Either you end up loving someone, or the process fizzles out before full-fledged love emerges. Falling in love also seems to be an activity or process. It involves not just love-like feelings of affection, but also action. Making plans, perusing the object of your affection's social media, seeking their company, taking steps to learn about them. In many cases, there does not seem to be a duty to fall in love. Suppose my local coffee shop has hired a new barista. I find them charming, funny, and handsome. What started as feelings of friendliness slowly begins to change. I have butterflies in my tummy when I see them. I make excuses to visit the coffee shop more often than usual. I am overly excited when they remember my name. Oh no, I am falling in love with them. Well, falling in love with all the time and emotional energy it takes would be inconvenient for me right now. So, rather than let it run its natural course, I intervene. I start going to a different coffee shop and keep myself distracted. I eventually forget about my handsome, charming barista. Here I do not seem to have violated any duty to myself or anyone else. I had no duty to fall in love with my barista. Yet, unlike falling in love, were I to choose to cut my grief short before it runs its natural course, I would violate the duty to grieve. What generates the duty to grieve from the imperfect duty to acquire self-knowledge is that grief, at least in its most paradigmatic instances, is accompanied by emotions, feelings, and the like that make it a rich opportunity for the kind of reflection leading to self-knowledge. However, like grieving, falling in love is an emotionally rich activity. If you've fallen in love, you know this to be true. As Brogard, 2015, pages 12 to 16, points out, falling in love involves feelings of anxiety and stress, pleasure and self-confidence. That is not the only similarity between falling in love and grieving. In grief, one ascertains the proper role that one's relationship with the deceased will have in one's practical identity, given that the relationship can no longer play the precise role it played during her lifetime, page 154. In falling in love, one ascertains the role that one's relationship with another person will have in one's practical identity, given that it did not play that role before. At the end of grief, Avang incorporated a revised relationship into the practical identity that guides our day-to-day activities and choices. We come to know what living well by our own lights consists in and can be rationally satisfied that we are pursuing what is in fact our good, page 159. Suppose that had I let myself fall in love with my barista, I would have come to love them. Then I would have incorporated this new relationship into my practical identity, and arguably through that process, could come to know what living well by my own lights, with my new love for my barista, consists in. Given these similarities, it seems that if there is a duty to grieve and let grief run its natural course, there is also a duty to fall in love and let falling in love run its natural course. I was wrong to avoid my barista. Now, there is something naturally ruminating and inward-looking about grief that is not typically as present when we fall in love. This may make grief a better tool for achieving self-knowledge than falling in love. Given that difference, while falling in love may be a rich opportunity for self-knowledge, unlike grief, it may not have self-knowledge as its proper end. And perhaps that is why we have a duty to grieve but not a duty to fall in love. But if that is so, then it is not clear to me whether it is grief's potential for self-knowledge that generates a duty to grieve. Rather, the duty to grieve seems to me to take the following form. Given that you are grieving or are in a position to grieve, you should grieve well, where grieving well terminates in self-knowledge. Here it is not the self-knowledge per se generating the duty to grieve. Instead, it seems required by a form of perfectionism. When doing something, do it well. Overall, I found this book incredibly helpful and insightful. If Kalbei's account of grief raises further questions, I think that is evidence of the philosophical value of grief.
Article 3, Grief and the Emotion, by Aaron Benzaev. Michael Kalbei's book, Grief, A Philosophical Guide, is an excellent book, is profound, original, and a pleasure to read despite its sad topic. The major claims are presented in a clear and persuasive manner. The structure and style of the book are accessible, not merely to philosophers. In what follows, I naturally focus on our disagreements, grief, and emotions. There are various ways to write a philosophical book on a specific emotion, such as grief. One way is to present a comprehensive theory of emotions, in light of which the specific emotion is analyzed. A second approach is to focus on one emotion and to build a philosophical theory around it. Both ways are legitimate and have their own advantages and disadvantages. One advantage of the second method is the ability to provide a fresh outlook on the topic, while not being bound by general theory. A disadvantage is the lack of a more comprehensive outlook. It is common among those using the first way to overlook differences between various emotions. Likewise, those using the second approach tend to overlook similarities between various, and often all, emotions. Kalbei chose the second approach, and his presentation is characterized by both its advantages and disadvantages. Kalbei presents a detailed and profound account of grief. I applaud Kalbai's discussion and agree with many of his central claims. However, I do have several concerns regarding his view on other emotions aside from grief. It seems that Kalbai goes out of his way to emphasize the differences between grief and other emotions, thereby underestimating their similarities. Kalbai suggests three unique features of grief which are unlike most emotional conditions. 1. Grief is a concatenation of affective states rather than a single such state. 2. Grief is not a perception-like state, but a form of affectively latent attention directed at its object. And 3. Grief is an activity with an inchoate aim. While I essentially accept this characterization, I believe that these arguments are not unique to grief, but common to all, or at least most emotions. I believe that all emotions are complex experiences that do not consist of a single state, but rather a cluster of emotions. Thus, guilt may be associated with fear. Love may incorporate jealousy, hope, and admiration. And hate may be connected with anger, fear, envy, and contempt. These connections are not accidental. Rather, they express the fact that each emotional situation is unstable, and our emotions are directed at imaginary and not merely real situations. Thus, great love and joy are associated with possible jealousy and fear stemming from the possibility of losing the beloved. Benzeyev, 2000, pages 3-5. I also believe that all emotions do not merely create a perception-like state, but a more complex evaluative experience, in which the motivational component, expressed in our behavior or behavioral tendencies, is central. This is the reason the title of my major book on emotions is The Subtlety of Emotions, Benzeyev, 2000. Grief's Focus of Concern. Kalbai argues that grief's formal object, which I consider as its focus of concern, is the bereaved individual's relationship with the deceased, a relationship that has been invariably transformed by the latter's death. While I agree that the self has a central place in grief, so does the deceased. We can also experience grief for someone who has no direct relation to us or our lives. For example, I experienced grief while reading about the brutal murder of the Swedish journalist Kim Wall on the submarine of the Danish entrepreneur Peter Madsen. I have no connection to Kim Wall, and my relationship with her will not be transformed by the experience. The death of our beloved is negatively experienced, not merely because we feel that something within us has died and our life has lost a valuable aspect, but also for the sake of the deceased whose life has tragically ended. Disregarding the deceased as a major part of grief makes grief a too egocentric emotion. We can find other meaningful relationships that can somehow replace the deceased, but the deceased's opportunities and horizons have just ended. As in other moral attitudes, in grief the other has its own merit that we should value. The egocentric aspect of grief. Michael Kalbai argues that we grieve when and because the death of another person is particularly or acutely significant for us. I will refer to this as the egocentric aspect of grief. Note that this term does not imply that grief is selfish. Grief, I shall argue in this book, is self-concerning and in a broad sense of the term, self-interested. Although I agree that, like all other emotions, grief involves a personal and interested attitude, I believe this is different from being egocentric. Egocentric is defined as thinking only of oneself, without regard for the feelings or desires of others, Oxford English Dictionary. This self-centeredness does not make grief and emotions in general egoistic since it does not involve thinking only of oneself. In grief, as in other emotions, the self-other relation is central. In grief and in profound love, the two concerns are compatible, so the egoistic nature is not central. The personal and interested nature of emotions indeed gives rise to the claim that emotions are egoistic. However, since emotions concern not only us, but also others who relate to us, family, friends, people in one's country, the personal nature of emotions is not necessarily egoistic. Along the same line of thought, Martha Nussbaum argues that the personal nature of emotions does not make them egoistic. Nussbaum, 2001, page 53. The extra weight given by Kalbai to the subject in Grief is expressed not merely in the claim that grief is essentially egoistic, but also in the major characterization of grief by Kalbai. Grief rests on identity investment. This seems to be an over-intellectualization of grief. I do not recall myself investing in my identity, at least not in a significant manner, in all major deaths that I have personally experienced. Two brothers, parents, close friends, and extended relatives dying prematurely. I would rather use the more general and somewhat vague notion of closeness as the central aspect of grief. It should be emphasized that in closeness, I refer first and foremost to psychological closeness. In this sense, we can feel psychological closeness toward celebrities, political leaders, and sports heroes, and hence can also grieve the loss of them. I agree that grief and other emotions tell us something important about our nature. However, I would not define the nature of grief as being concerned with self-knowledge. Hence, I consider Kalbai's claim that successful grieving culminates in a desirable epistemic condition, self-knowledge, as highly problematic. The epistemic consideration in emotions is of lesser weight than the evaluative and motivational aspects. Emotional theories. Kalbai discerns three classes of emotional theories. 1. Bodily awareness. 2. Cognitive theories. And 3. Perceptual theories. This division is problematic for several reasons. First, there is no mention of a significant class of theories. The motivational ones, according to which the essence of emotions is activity or action readiness, e.g., Nico Frigida, 2007, Jean-Paul Sartre, 2015. Kalbai's failure to add this prevailing class of theories is surprising in light of his claim that grief is an activity. Second, perception is a major cognitive tool, so perceptual theories should be part of the cognitive class. Third, the important evaluative theory is spread over the cognitive and perceptual classes of theories. All these are minor criticisms of Kalbai's view, as he claims to investigate the nature of grief in a largely theory-neutral way. The temporality of emotional experiences. Kalbai argues that grief is an emotional process, and this makes it atypical in comparison to most other emotions, which are not helpfully described as kinder processes. Fear, for instance, unfolds over time, but is one state, not many. I believe that the temporal dimension of emotions is much more complex than Kalbai claims, even though his characterization of the temporal dimension of grief is essentially correct. We can talk about three major types of emotional temporality. 1. Acute emotions. 2. Extended emotions. And 3. Enduring emotions. Acute emotions are brief, almost instantaneous experiences. Extended emotions involve successive repetitions of experiences that are felt to belong to the same emotion. For example, being angry or jealous for hours. Enduring emotions are the longest lasting of the three and can persist for a lifetime. In addition to the occurrence of acute and extended emotions, enduring emotions involves a qualitative, meaningful development and sometimes deterioration and a dispositional nature that unfolds over time. Benziev, 2019. No doubt, grief is often an enduring emotion, but so are love, regret, hate, guilt, shame, and various other emotions. All the characteristics that Kalbai uniquely attributes to grief are present in these emotions, and sometimes, as in the case of romantic love, to an even greater degree. Thus, the aspect of development is more pronounced in love than in grief. Like grief, these enduring emotions also color our environment. The distinction Kalbai often uses between grief, which is a process and activity, and an emotional state, such as fear, anger, etc., is problematic. All emotions are not passive states, but rather involve dynamic processes and activities. Moreover, grief often involves passivity in light of prominent feelings of helplessness, following an irrevocable loss. All emotions have some duration and are not merely one instantaneous state. Longer duration of an emotion enables more meaningful processes. The paradox of grief. Kalbai presents what he terms the paradox of grief. The paradox consists of two seemingly contrary claims. One, grief feels bad, and so should be avoided or lamented. And two, grief is valuable, such that we ought not avoid it altogether and should be grateful that we grieve. While the paradox seems interesting, Kalbeis claim that there is no correlative paradox for other comparably stressful life events, 70, is simply wrong. This apparent paradox actually exists in almost all life events or experiences concerning negative emotions, such as sadness, regret, anger, fear, and shame. All of them involve negative emotion, while at the same time have a positive survival and normative value. I believe that we can formulate the same paradox concerning anger, fear, and shame. To sum up, this is an excellent book on grief, which I highly recommend. The book could be even stronger if the author paid more attention to the similarity between grief and other emotions, thereby enhancing a general theory of emotions. After all, grief too is an emotion. Article 4, Grief's Badness and the Paradox of Grief, by Travis Timmerman. Michael Kalbeis' Grief, a Philosophical Guide, manages to be maximally clear without sacrificing any argumentative rigor. It covers much new ground in an area of philosophy that is surprisingly underexplored and, in doing so, significantly advances our collective philosophical understanding of grief. More precisely, the book, in my view, convincingly rules out existing accounts of grief, demonstrates that grief is not a narrative nor is it experienced as a narrative, shows that grief is an emotional process and not an emotion, that grief is something we do rather than something that happens to us, that it is egocentric, that the forward and backwards looking dimension of grief are really one activity, that one good typically seen in grief is the self-knowledge it produces, and that grief's rationality is backward looking. Since grief is an emotional process almost universally experienced by humans and some non-human animals, these advancements in our understanding of the nature of grief proves important not only for those in the field, but for everyone who can read and understand the book. Kalbeis begins by convincingly ruling out the most salient and popular accounts of grief by way of counterexamples. Grief cannot require that the bereaved must have a form of intimacy with the deceased, since people grieve the deaths of public figures they don't know, parents one never met, and so on. Kalbeis 2022, pages 23 to 29. Nor can love be the relationship needed to ground grief, since it is supposed people don't literally love the public figures they grieve, pages 26 to 28. More surprisingly, enemies have even apparently grieved the loss of one another. Castro was said to have grieved John F. Kennedy after he died. Grief cannot be restricted to those whom were attached for similar reasons, page 26. After ruling out these alternatives, Kalbeis proceeds to give his positive view. The central feature of Kalbeis' positive account is that, fitting, grief is a response to one's death, disrupting our practical identities. As he puts it, the deaths of those in whom our practical identities are invested represents a kind of relationship crisis for us, page 57. Their deaths entail that they cannot play the same role in our lives which we presumed they would, CH2, section 10. This is not just a description of what grief is, but part of the criteria of what makes grief fitting. Kalbeis writes that our practical identities are, in a diversity of ways, invested in the existence of others. We grieve a person's death, and it is appropriate that we grieve a person's death to the extent that our practical identities are invested in their existence. The more central another person is to our practical identity, the greater cause we have for grieving them upon their deaths, page 31. There is an upshot to this grief too. As Kalbeis puts it, grief is uniquely positioned to give us a kind of self-knowledge, a knowledge of who we have been and who we seek to be, page 85. This kind of self-knowledge is the purpose of grief, and it's what makes grief prudentially valuable. I find this positive account of grief intriguing and believe there is much that can be said in its favor. Kalbeis, in fact, makes about as convincing a case as possible for it. Nevertheless, I want to push back on it in the same way he pushed back on the competing accounts of grief by way of counterexample. While I am convinced that the disruption of our practical identities is an important part of typical and paradigmatic instances of grief, as I will argue below, it's not a necessary condition of appropriate grieving. Purported counterexamples. Appropriately grieving a death that did not change one's practical identity. Kalbai mentioned that the lamentations people sometimes feel when a public figure has died are indeed instances of grief, and fitting instances of grief too. That strikes me as plausible, but the problem is not all of these seeming instances of grief produced any obvious change in one's practical identity. Sometimes a public figure has enormously influenced a culture, shaped countless people's public identities, and then retired from their work and receded from the public eye long before they die. Legendary film actor Kirk Douglas died on February 5, 2020 at the age of 103, having not acted in a film or television production in over a decade. He blogged occasionally for the Huffington Post, but had stopped doing that a few years before he died as well. His recession from the public life may have changed his fans' practical identities, but his death didn't bring about an obvious change in anyone's practical identity, except for those near and dear to him. His fans' practical identities seemingly remained intact, or largely intact, and there is no evidence of any of his grieving fans acquiring self-knowledge of who they have been and who they seek to be. Nevertheless, from his fans, there was an outpouring of love, support, and what seems to me to be fitting grief for Douglas when he died. If I am right, then grief's formal object needn't only be deaths that bring about a change in our practical identities. It might also, or instead, be the deaths of people who have, while alive, brought a change in our practical identities. Perhaps the latter is a sufficient, but not necessary, condition for appropriate grief. The Kirk Douglas example is supposed to be an instance of a death that warrants grief, but does not result in a disruption of one's practical identity. It also seems to me that there can be cases that result in a radical disruption of one's practical identity, but do not warrant grief. In Kalbai's words, what unites all those for whom we grieve is what I call practical identity investment. Each of us embraces some set of commitments, values, and concerns. This set guides most all our choices and actions. It includes those things that matter to us in more than a momentary or fleeting way. In this respect, these commitments, values, and concerns help to give shape and direction to our lives. We invoke them to explain why we make pivotal life choices, to give an accounting of ourselves when others misunderstand or question what we do, and to give our lives a measure of integrity. Page 30. Death that brings about a change in one's practical identity but doesn't warrant grief. As Kalbai astutely observes, others play a role in our practical identities by being objects of love, by sharing values or goals with us, and by caring for us. Thus, our practical identities are, in a diversity of ways, invested in the existence of others. We grieve a person's death, and it is appropriate that we grieve a person's death to the extent that our practical identities are invested in their existence. Page 31. This seems right to me in most, but not all, cases. The cases that are exceptions to this rule are as follows. Sometimes the death that brings about a disruption in one's practical identity makes that person realize that the values that comprise their practical identity were wrong. Having this dawn on someone could instantaneously instill some new values in the person, some values that could make them only happy their practical identity changed. Such a change doesn't seem to warrant egocentric grief. To illustrate, consider a specific example. Last year, someone wrote into an advice column in Slate with a case that fit this bill. Her family was critical of her for not grieving her abusive husband's death. In her words, "He was a miserable, vindictive man whose greatest joy was tearing me down. He cheated on me constantly and would cheerfully recount all my inadequacies compared with his mistresses. If I left, he would pursue me to the ends of the earth. Once he died, she felt free and embraced being single and autonomous for the rest of her life." Now, from the column, it's not clear the extent to which her 15-year marriage to this man shaped her practical identity, but it seems reasonable to assume it had an enormous impact on her practical identity. Even if it didn't in actuality, Let's imagine that it did for the purposes of the thought experiment. Now, here's the problem. According to Kalbai, people in fact grieve a person's death when it changes their practical identity, and it is only fitting to do so under this condition. However, the case at hand seems, to me, to be a counterexample to both claims. This woman did not grieve the death of her husband, and for the reasons given, it seems perfectly appropriate for her to have not grieved his death. While his death disrupted her practical identity, it, we may suppose, resulted in an improved practical identity, one that was not only objectively better, but one she immediately endorsed. As such, not grieving her husband's death seems perfectly appropriate, and grieving his death, given these stipulations, actually seems inappropriate. If this is right, then grief is not simply appropriate insofar as our practical identities are invested in the existence of the person who dies. Sometimes our practical identities are deeply invested in people they shouldn't be. We don't fully appreciate that until they die, and we, if we're lucky, acquire a new practical identity and are only happy with the change. In such cases, it seems appropriate not to grieve, and even inappropriate to grieve. It's worth noting that this example bears certain similarities to the example of Castro grieving the death of John F. Kennedy. I admit that I find it a bit surprising, even odd, that Castro grieved the death of Kennedy. I accept that he did, though, and I even accept that it may have been appropriate for Castro to grieve Kennedy's death. Nevertheless, it's important to recognize that our intuitions about that case are almost certainly influenced by the fact that people in the United States generally don't believe that Kennedy deserved to die. For all his faults, he is regarded as an overall decent person and a generally good, even great president. Castro, on the other hand, is rightly regarded as a dictator responsible for the deaths of thousands upon thousands of innocent Cubans. Whether or not this is a completely accurate picture, Castro is seen as a bad person grieving the death of a good enemy, and that may be a necessary condition for grief to be appropriate between enemies. The Slate case I provided is the reverse of the Castro-Kennedy case. It's likely to be seen as a good person not grieving the death of a bad enemy. If this is right, then judgments about whether the person who died deserved to die, or whose death made the world better or worse, is likely influencing our judgments about grief. Not only that, but it's plausible that the moral character of the grievers is also playing a role in our judgments about the appropriateness of grief. However, these considerations play no role in Kalbai's positive account of grief. Perhaps grief should be understood as requiring some perceived negative, or at least not solely positive, change in one's practical identity, where the change is or ought to be seen as negative in some sense by the person in question. Furthermore, I am not sure whether grief is fitting between two enemies when the deceased enemy either deserved to die or made the world a better place by dying. It does seem at least prima facie odd to say that one can appropriately grieve their enemy if their enemy was a moral monster. It wouldn't seem appropriate for, say, one of Pinochet's victims to have grieved his death, even though Pinochet's actions played an enormous role in shaping their practical identity. With this in mind, I will now turn to the so-called paradox of grief. The paradox of grief. The paradox of grief consists of the following two claims. 1. Grief feels bad, and so should be avoided or lamented. 2. Grief is valuable, such that we, and others, ought not avoid it altogether, and should be grateful that we grieve. Page 70. This is supposed to seem paradoxical, because each claim supposedly seems true, and yet, they appear to be in tension, if not strictly inconsistent. Kalbai succinctly sums the paradox up, writing that grief feels bad for the bereaved, but could nevertheless be beneficial to her. Page 71. I am first going to review Kalbai's proposed solution to the paradox, then explain why I don't find it satisfactory. After that, I will review an existing solution Kalbai rejected, and argue that there is more to be said in favor of this solution than Kalbai allows. Kalbai's proposed solution to the paradox of grief. In a nutshell, Kalbai argues that 1. Is false. While grief certainly feels bad for the person grieving, Kalbai argues that it is, in fact, not bad for the person in the context of grief and should not actually be avoided or lamented. page 122. Kalbai grants that, in another context, the exact same feeling would be bad. But in the context of grief, Kalbai argues that the pains of grief do not present themselves as pure cost to the bereaved and are seen as desirable in their own right, as the grieving are invested in the whole experience, and not merely the good it produces, pages 114 to 116. In Kalbai's words, investment in some good involves seeing the means to that good not just as cost to be borne, bads which one willingly suffers in the hope of attaining the good one seeks. The means are instead viewed as good because of the integral causal relationship they stand into substantial self-knowledge. Grief's pains thus come to be desired because they represent an investment in the goodness of grief. Page 114. The reason for this rational investment, Kalbai argues, is a certain kind of self-knowledge. This is supposed to explain condition, page 2. That self-knowledge will be the culmination of the backward and forward-looking dimension of grief. Once the grieving process begins, there will, according to Kalbai, be a gap between knowing that the person is dead and fully emotionally engaging with this fact, page 77. The backward-looking dimension of grief aims to, in Kalbai's words, bridge this gap from the fact that the person is dead to an appreciation of who is dead and why their deaths matter to us, page 78. This is a gap that opens up largely thanks to the all-too-human tendency to ignore our reliance on others and our practical identities. And because death transforms our relationship with the deceased, grief makes it no longer possible to take those relationships for granted, page 78. Their death forces us to grapple with them head-on. The forward-looking dimension of grief is supposed to serve a similar, yet distinct, purpose. Specifically, Kalbai argues that it aims to identify how, if at all, our relationship with the deceased will continue in light of the change in background realities that their death has wrought, page 81. In typical cases of grief, the culmination of the backward and forward-looking dimensions allows us to emerge from grief with a rejuvenated practical identity and a more stable sense of self as a result of the richer knowledge of who we have been and who we seek to be, which we gain from our grief. Now that I have explained Kalbai's proposed solution to the paradox, I want to raise a few concerns about it. Pain is always intrinsically bad. First, I have a hard time understanding how the indescribable agony of grief is not supposed to be intrinsically bad, even in the larger context of grief. I can certainly understand how it's supposed to be extrinsically good and all things considered good for the reasons Kalbai gave. And I can see why, for these reasons, it would be imprudent to artificially mitigate one's grief. I can also understand various moral reasons why one might want to suffer grief. Such feelings of grief may be morally good, even if they're prudentially bad. But I see no reason to think that the agony of grief itself isn't intrinsically bad. To motivate the idea it isn't, Kalbai offers an analog case, citing the intense sensations of fatigue, shortness of breath, and muscle aches that come with long-distance running. In other contexts, these painful experiences may seem bad, but, claims Kalbai, they're not bad in the context of running, page 119. I'm not convinced, however. As with the grief example, I can see how these intense sensations are extrinsically good insofar as they contribute to the overall pleasurableness of the experience. But I don't see how they could be intrinsically good if they are indeed painful, as is being assumed. It seems to me that, ceteris paribus, you really should want to feel less pain when you run. Likewise, ceteris paribus, you really should want to grieve less. For instance, someone who has grieved for months and months over a friend's death and will gain the same self-knowledge to the same degree whether her grief subsides today or tomorrow should, prudentially, at least, prefer that it subsides today. Should you take the grief eradicating pill? Before I discuss my more substantive concern, it's worth noting that Kalbai motivated, too, above by appealing to a thought experiment. If you had a pill that would wipe out the grief of a bereaved friend, it would supposedly seem wrong to offer it to the friend in question, page 69. Again, the reason why, Kalbai suggests, is that grief is valuable for the bereaved. It's in their prudential interest to grieve in typical cases, and so the thought goes, it would be wrong to offer to take that away from them. I'm not sure I share the judgment that you shouldn't offer them the pill, though I feel the intuitive pull of the claim that they shouldn't take the pill. This judgment is, I suspect, widely shared and strongly held. What is interesting, though, is that Kalbai's positive account of grief cannot account for this judgment in a wide variety of cases. More directly, it seemingly entails that grief should often be avoided, perhaps more so than he would like to admit. To see why, consider the following case. Magic pill. Imagine this grief-eradicating magic pill not only preemptively eliminates any grief, but also imparts the self-knowledge one would have gained had they grieved. Perhaps the pill implants false memories of grief that are connected to the self-knowledge, or perhaps the person simply comes to have the self-knowledge independent of any memories of grief. On Kalbai's view, it seems good for one to avoid grief in this case. Though, I wonder whether he still believes the potentially grief-stricken should not take the pill. If so, then why? Perhaps there are moral reasons to grieve, though in this case, there would have to be other regarding moral reasons for the deceased, perhaps, and not the self-regarding moral reasons Kalbai identifies in Chapter 6. This is because the magical pill in this case provides the same self-knowledge as grief would, and so removes the self-regarding reasons Kalbai identifies to grieve. There could only be a self-regarding moral obligation to take the pill or grieve. But, and this is the important point, even if there are such other regarding moral reasons to grieve, they wouldn't provide reason to believe, one, is true. Such considerations are not limited to magic pill cases either. Imagine a husband and wife who've been together over 60 years and will die within 1 week of each other. In most actual cases, this amount of time plausibly won't nearly be enough for the grief episode to conclude and result in the kind of self-knowledge Kalbai talks about. Would it be best for the surviving member of the couple to live out the last week of their life grief-free? For what it's worth, I am inclined to hold that it is prudentially best for the person to live without grief in such cases. But I wonder whether Kalbai agrees that grief is bad and to be avoided in these cases. I also believe it would generally be morally permissible for them to avoid grief to the extent they can, though I suspect most people think otherwise. If so, then it's not clear how much weight we should put into the conclusion drawn from Kalbai's pill thought experiment. A large influencing factor of typical judgments in Kalbai's pill case could be tracking this other regarding moral ought and not the kind of prudential ought Kalbai has in mind. We should accept one and two. My favorite solution to the paradox of grief allows us to accept one and two rather than having to reject one. This is referred to as the pain as a cost solution in the text, pages 108-109-113. The basic idea is grief is indeed intrinsically bad for the person grieving and, ceteris paribus, should be avoided and lamented. Nevertheless, paradigmatic instances of grief are extrinsically good because they can lead to the kind of self-knowledge Kalbai identified, minimize suffering in the long run given our psychologies, and so on. As such, we can acknowledge that grief is valuable, remain grateful that we grieve, and rationally not avoid it, insofar as doing so is good for us. Kalbai considers this solution, but ultimately rejects it because it would supposedly imply that it would be rational to desire that grief's pains be minimized, presumably assuming that the good of self-knowledge would be held fixed in such cases. Page 109. Kalbai takes this to be an implication of the view, when combined with a general principle he finds plausible. That principle holds that if we are incurring a cost in order to obtain a benefit, we ought rationally prefer to minimize that cost. Page 108. There are 2 points worth making in response. First, I do not believe this solution actually entails that one should desire that grief's pain be minimized for reasons already given. Rather, it only needs to acknowledge that holding the prudential goods, e.g., self-knowledge, fixed, it would be prudentially best for one's grief to be minimized. That strikes me as not only as an unproblematic claim, but a claim that is quite plausibly true. This isn't even a bullet to bite, as far as I can tell. To see why, consider again someone who has grieved for months and months and months over a friend's death and will gain the same self-knowledge to the same degree whether her grief subsides today or tomorrow. It seems to be clearly better for her to have her grief subside today rather than tomorrow. Second, in spite of these prudential considerations, one can accept this proposed solution and deny that it would be rational to desire that grief's pains be minimized by appealing to other regarding moral considerations. I suspect most people would think it's morally wrong to forego, or try and minimize, grieving the death of, say, a loved one, even if it's prudent to do so. They presumably think we owe it to the deceased to grieve for them. I personally don't accept that we have duties to the deceased, but that is irrelevant to the point at hand. One can, and I suspect many do, consistently accept the pain as a cause solution to the paradox of grief without having to hold that one rationally ought to desire that their grief be minimized, much less completely pain-free. This solution has the advantage of accounting for what I take to be the common sense, and at least prima facie plausible, judgment that pain is intrinsically bad. Kalbi's favorite solution has to reject this claim. Unless this view can be shown to be subject to some counterintuitive implications, I am inclined to accept it over a solution that requires rejecting 1. And denying that pain is intrinsically bad, as Kalbi's solution does. Conclusion. I want to end by explicitly stating that I found much more to agree with in Kalbi's manuscript than to disagree with, and that I learned a great deal from reading it. This book will be a welcome addition to the philosophical literature on grief, but its value will extend far beyond that to anyone who will have to deal with grief. This is, unfortunately, nearly everyone.
This marks the end of the 2022 Volume 4, Issue 1 Summer Podcast Edition, Part 1, of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion. Please go to 2022 Volume 4, Issue 1 Summer Podcast Edition, Part 2, of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion, to continue listening to this issue.